everybody. I'm Farron Cousins, and welcome to the all-new Ring of Fire podcast. I'm excited to be here. For those who listened last week, Sam Cedar officially signed off, handed the show over to me, and we will get more into that in just a little bit. But hey, today we've got a wonderful show coming up. We've got John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's going to talk to us about the ongoing controversy surrounding the members of Congress who have been implicated by rally organizers from the Stop the Steal rally as helping them actually coordinate what happened. And we're going to talk about what needs to happen with these members of Congress. Nichols is also going to tell us about Tuesday's elections and what it means for the future of the Democratic Party, especially with highly contentious midterms just 1 year away now. Hey, we've got some all new ways you can listen to this Ring of Fire podcast as well. You can find us on Facebook Podcasts. And of course, don't forget, subscribe to our YouTube channel where we have fresh content for you 7 days a week. It's youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Follow us on Twitter at Ring of Fire Media. You can follow me on Twitter at Farron Balanced. So as I mentioned, to kick off this show, I am Farron Cousins. I am the new host of Ring of Fire, but I'm certainly not new to Ring of Fire. For those of you who have been longtime listeners all the way back to the Air America days, you may know me if you're, you know, fans of our YouTube channel that now has crossed the 800,000 subscriber mark. We are one of the top progressive YouTube channels out there. We're continuing to grow. It's wonderful. I do that every single day. So please check it out, youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. But I did want to take a moment to talk a little bit about myself. And I know that seems really weird, but I just want everybody to know who I am and why I'm here. As I mentioned, I've been with Ring of Fire since the Air America days. In fact, about 3 months after Ring of Fire even formed is when I joined, in August of 2004. I began as a researcher, just providing materials for Pap and Bobby, who were running the show at the time when it was just a weekend radio show, evolved into a producer from there. Then, of course, all the other projects we've done over the years, Go Left TV, which we launched in 2007. I did the daily morning program, The Daily Left. And then once we shuttered that, we moved over to Free Speech TV. I did a lot of hosting for Ring of Fire on that. I was a guest frequently with Mike. Guest hosting stints with Tom Hartman and Ed Schultz. You probably heard me on there with Pap. And then, of course, we had a short-lived program on TYT's television network that I hosted. Unfortunately, we just didn't have the time to continue doing that. What with the YouTube channel, the radio show, Mike's America's Lawyer program. So I've been here with Ring of Fire in many, many different capacities over the years. Again, researching, producing, hosting, just all kinds of things. And it really, it's surreal to me to be taking over this show. Because again, when I started, I was just a guy that read articles and pulled information and pulled statistics, you know, diving deep into all this, trying to find angles and come up with talking points that nobody else was coming up with. And I never, you know, when I joined here, never thought I would be sitting in this chair. I never thought it would be me on this side of the microphone. So, you know, I am so grateful for this opportunity, and I hope to continue on in the tradition that, you know, Sam Cedar laid out for you on this podcast. And he's been a tremendous mentor, a tremendous friend. And our relationship with him is certainly not over with by any stretch. So don't think that, you know, we're never going to talk to him again. No, Sam is still a good friend of all of ours here. And we will continue to talk to him and work with him regularly on, you know, anything that we can. But we're also going to do things a little different. You know, I don't want to completely revamp the show, but I do want to change things up a little bit every now and then. That's good. You know, keep it different, keep it spicy. And that's one of the things we're doing. And so this week, unfortunately, due to some issues we had earlier in the week, it's been quite a hell of a week. We're not going to have a full-on member show. That will all be back next week, so do not worry about that. We appreciate all of our members. We want to continue giving you, you know, everything that you're subscribed to. This week kind of caught us off guard a little bit. We had some guests that didn't come through, but, you know, that's the reality of this this business. It happens all the time, and I've been a little rusty because I haven't had to, you know, do the producing part of it and hosting and interviewing folks, but I'm back in the swing now, and next week we will have our full-on member show. So if you're not a member, if you're only listening to the free portion here, I do encourage everyone, you can sign up, go to rofpodcast.com. And as I mentioned, new ways to listen. We're going to be on Facebook Podcast. We are on Facebook Podcast right now. You can also, if you choose to instead become a member of our Patreon or our YouTube community at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire, patreon.com/TheRingOfFire. There's going to be member tiers where you can also get the podcast there, including the members and the, of course, the interviews that I do. We're going to be posting the videos on there for our YouTube community and Patreon members. So we're definitely expanding the ways that you can listen to this. But I've talked about me. I've talked about this show enough, right? It's time to get into the news. It's time to get into some issues here, because there's a lot of things that have been happening pretty much every minute of every day. But there's one thing that I want to highlight that I feel has gone grossly underreported, but it shows where we truly are as a country. And I start with this, a little hypothetical for you, or a riddle, I guess. What do secretaries of state, election officials, judges, and school board members all have in common right now in America today? The answer is truly disturbing, because the answer is that all of those groups I mentioned are receiving death threats from crazed Trump supporters. Crazed right-wingers are threatening these individuals, and all, you know, not necessarily all for different reasons, but the reasons do vary. Secretaries of state, including Republican secretaries of state like Brad Raffensperger from the state of Georgia, are receiving death threats from Trump supporters for refusing to overturn the results of the 2020 election. And that, of course, is also happening with the election officials that I mentioned. And when we talk about election officials, we're not just talking about elected officials who help run elections in states. Even volunteers have been getting death threats from Trump supporters. On the other side of it, school boards, school board members are getting death threats from Trump supporters because these Trump supporters claim that these renegade school boards are wanting to mask and muzzle your children in order to protect them from COVID-19, which has not gone away. And then, of course, the judges. Judges are getting death threats from Trump supporters because they have the audacity to prosecute. Actually, they're not even the ones prosecuting. They're overseeing the trials, as judges do, of the Capitol rioters. Oh, let me throw in another person, another group, I guess, that's getting death threats. That would be Fox News hosts, specifically Neil Cavuto, because Cavuto made the grave mistake last weekend of encouraging people to get vaccinated, begging them essentially to get vaccinated, because Cavuto, who does have underlying health issues and is vaccinated, went through a nasty bout of COVID-19. He had a breakthrough case. He talked about it on the air, and then he encouraged people to get vaccinated. And that triggered these crazed anti-vax Trump supporters so much, they threatened to kill him. And he mentioned that on the air. And what I don't get is when you have people like Cavuto who go out there, they say these things, they make the pleas to the public, please protect yourself, is what he's saying. And they respond with, nope, I want to kill you instead. How can Cavuto continue to go on the air and push right-wing talking points to this same audience when he knows how they truly feel about him now? That blows my mind that you can still be such a partisan hack when your own party wants you dead And I guess the same thing goes for Brad Raffensperger, Georgia Secretary of State. He came out with a new book this week where he detailed the death threats that he has gotten from Trump supporters and the death threats his wife has gotten from Trump supporters. Said people were staking out his home. And so what has he done since then? Well, he has actually helped Georgia pass that massively disgusting voter suppression bill. So he's still being a good little Republican, even though they've threatened to kill him. This is where we're at as a country. These Trump supporters, these people issuing these death threats, every single one of them needs to be investigated. And if it turns into, you know, whatever, they need to be prosecuted. That's what has to happen here. You do not have the freedom in the United States of America to tell another person that you were going to end their life. That is not protected speech. But that is happening at an alarming rate. And again, it's all coming from the same group of people. These crazed right-wingers. Because this is what they want America to be. If you do not agree with us on every single issue, and that is important to point out, because Cavuto agrees with them on like 95% of the issues. Brad Raffensperger is about 99% of the issues. He just wouldn't overturn the election because he couldn't do it. Cavuto's mortal sin was telling people to protect themselves from a pandemic. Other than that, they all agree on everything. But it's not enough. There is no room for dissent. If you do not agree with everything, we want you dead, is the message these Trump supporters are sending here in the United States today. This is the country we now live in. And it will continue to get worse. It absolutely will, because nothing's happening to these individuals. And that's the scariest part of this. This could lead to another January 6th type situation. And in fact, I firmly believe if we do nothing about it, that it absolutely will. Last week, we got the bombshell report from Rolling Stone magazine identifying multiple members of Congress and a couple of folks from the actual Trump administration who, according to a couple of people involved, actually helped organize the events of January 6th, specifically the Stop the Steal rally. And so far, even though it's only been a week and a half or so, not much has happened with these members of Congress. So I am joined now by the great John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. John, we have members of Congress, you know, the usual suspects, obviously, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Mo Brooks, Madison Cawthorn, Lauren Boebert, and a host of others that were actively identified by these people that said these members of Congress were working with us to set up this rally. And I know there's been a lot of news since then, but I almost feel like at this point, everybody's already kind of moved on from this massive story that's only a week and a half old. I mean, this should be huge news and something needs to be done here.
Absolutely. You got it. And I think this is the problem of the moment we live in, right? We get huge news dumps every day, much of it very, very important. You know, we're trying to save a planet and Biden's trying to govern in D.C. We have off-year elections that are sending some very powerful signals. And it's very easy to kind of jump from one thing to the next. But that's a mistake because the revelations as regards what happened on January 6th keep coming. They're coming via the January 6th committee, a bipartisan committee in the House. They're coming via investigations by other routes. They're coming both from official sources and from the news media. And what they point to is a much bigger conspiracy, a much more serious set of events that need to be, A, investigated with an eye toward identifying wrongdoers, B, when you've got that initial investigation done, then you need to go into a deeper inquiry to clarify whether people who've been accused of wrongdoing actually engaged in it, i.e. these members of Congress, did they actually conspire with planners, as has been suggested? And then see if that is the case, then they need to be removed from the House of Representatives. And we shouldn't be cautious about that. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, Section 3, is very clear. It says that if you have given aid and comfort to insurrectionists, as someone who swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, you are barred from holding public office. And they specifically mentioned the Congress and the U.S. Senate in that regard. And so we've got a moment now where it is necessary to identify, investigate, and where necessary, expel members of Congress who supported and sustained the January 6th insurrection. If we fail to do so, as a country, and if Congress specifically fails to take the necessary actions through the Ethics Committee, I think there's very little question that these issues will come back and haunt us anew. There's no question Donald Trump is running for president in 2024. There's very little doubt that he will get the nomination. And there is no doubt that if he does get the nomination, no matter what the results are, he will claim victory. And if he loses, he will claim fraud and work allied members of Congress to try and overturn an election result. We know those realities that we should prepare for.
And, you know, when we talk about these members of Congress, you know, what they may have done and may not have done, because, of course, as you mentioned, we got to investigate. We can't Absolutely. Obviously just accept the word. I mean, look, I would love to just accept the word. And I do believe these people are being honest when they identified these members of Congress. Mm-hmm. But sure, absolute due process. But suppose we get to that point. What if we get to the point where we're actively able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt these individuals conspired with the rally organizers, with possibly even the insurrectionists? We would have to have what is, I think, 2/3 of the body of Congress vote to expel these members. Would that be a possibility if we had the evidence? I know right now, obviously, you're not going to get the Republicans to go with it. But if we had the evidence, are there enough Republicans willing to expel their own members?
It's a tough call. I think it's very clear that there's a lot of Republicans that would not vote to expel, no matter what evidence came out. But it's important to recognize that the Republican caucus did choose to take away committee chairmanships from Marjorie Taylor Greene, that there have been some other pushbacks and moves. I'm not romantic about this, and I don't want to suggest for a moment that this is an easy process. I'm telling you what the Constitution says. I'm telling you what should be done, what is the right response if you identify a member of Congress who engaged in insurrection or who gave aid and comfort to an insurrection. And I'm telling you that this is not something you can avoid. Now, what does that mean? Well, first and foremost, there is a resolution that Cori Bush has put forward. That resolution calls on the Ethics Committee to investigate and if they find evidence of wrongdoing in this regard, to propose expulsion of members of Congress. That's what the Cori Bush resolution proposes, and that's the starting point. So Democrats can pass that without a 2/3 majority. They can do it with a simple majority. They should do so. And by the way, it will be a bipartisan, I think, a bipartisan majority, because if the Ethics Committee comes up with solid evidence that one or more members of Congress actively aided and abetted the attack on the Capitol, or at least the planning for it, was engaged in it in ways that were, in fact, dangerous, damaging, threatening, then I think you'll get at least some Republicans that will vote for that. Now, that just, with the Cori Bush proposal, that just moves it, that moves it over to ethics for investigation. Then you move to that next stage of, how good an investigation is it? What can you do to actually make things happen? That's where we stand. And I think it's worth doing. I think it's necessary. And it also does one other thing, which, Farron, I think is important. The Constitution is clear on this. It doesn't say you can be expelled. It actually says you can't hold the office. And so, raising this issue and focusing on it empowers secretaries of state around the country to make the tough, and I fully admit it's a tough choice, to say that a candidate, perhaps a candidate for reelection, who has been clearly identified as having been engaged in insurrection, cannot be on the ballot in 2022 or 2024. That is a realistic prospect that the group Free Speech for People has raised.
Well, and I think it's important, too, that people understand that fact of it, because this isn't just about the current members of Congress that have been identified. We have other people who actively participated in the Capitol riot itself, that some of them made their way into the Capitol. They're running for office, okay? These are people who actively participated. They've announced candidacies. You know, they're going to primary this person over here. They're going to run for office over here, whether it's, you know, a school board, state office, some of them possibly even running for U.S. Congress. So it is important that this gets enforced so that we can stop these people from gaining future office. So it's not just about the expulsion of what we've got. It's also preventing these people from being in office in the future, because unfortunately, we're seeing quite a few of them that have political ambitions now.
Without a doubt. And so, I mean, these are, this is, again, I am not interested in penalizing people I disagree with. I think that's a dangerous game. If there's somebody who, you know, takes a stand on an issue that you don't like, even if it's a stand that you think is quite noxious, you know, that's a part of our political process. But it is different if you have proven that someone actively engaged in insurrection or in aiding and giving aid and comfort to the organizers of an insurrection. If you've got that, if that is a reality, then it becomes necessary to act. If we fail to act, then I think we dumb down the process to such an extent that we're effectively saying, yeah, look, you know, you can try and overturn the results of an election. You can try and overturn the government and then turn around and you know, sit in Congress in the next session. Why this becomes so troubling or why it becomes so concerning does bring us back to Trump, because Donald Trump has, refused to accept the results of the 2020 election, B, suggested that he is very likely, not certain, but I think there's pretty good evidence, going to run in 2024. And C, would come to that 2024 race with a proven record of trying to overturn an election. And so if you're saying, yeah, we're going to put people in Congress, we're going to let people be in Congress who have a history of engaging, trying to overturn elections in a situation where you might well face that exact circumstance again, you're just inviting a crisis. And probably a far more severe crisis than what we saw on January 6th.
You really are. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. And I got to talk about Mo Brooks, right? So Mo Brooks shows up at the Stop the Steal rally wearing body armor. It is difficult to think that Mo Brooks didn't have some kind of warning that things could get kind of rough and tumble that day. You don't just wake up and decide, you know what, I think I'm going to put on body armor today just because why not? So I do believe, at least with Mo Brooks, there was communication. Now, he's denied it. He attempted to throw his staff under the bus and said, well, I didn't plan anything. Maybe my staff could have talked to them. And if they did, good for them. You know, he actually praised them, even though he's trying to throw them under the bus. But look, you don't just show up with body armor on to give a speech. So I think, yeah, again, with the bare minimum, Mo Brooks, I think definitely had to have known something.
Well, these organizers, these planners of the January 6th actions, we don't know, you know, we don't know everything about who they are, but we know a couple of folks and also some other folks confirming the information, have identified at least six or seven members of Congress and staff from offices that could go up to as many as a dozen. And we do know some of the names, and Mo Brooks is definitely one of them. So too is Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz. In many ways, the usual suspects. As you suggest, and as I've suggested, we have to be careful to make sure that we don't accuse someone of doing something they didn't do.
Right.
But when we start to pile up the evidence, and when you have actual witnesses saying that they were there, that they had these conversations, that they engaged in these ways, then I think you're getting to a point where, at the very least, it demands a deep investigation. Again, if we go back to those three things I was talking about, identify, investigate, expel, right? If you we've already gotten through a lot of the identification process. We've got people pointing toward some members of Congress. You're adding more evidence and things that strengthen that case. That then takes us to the investigation mode. And yeah, you got to call witnesses, you got to talk to people, you got to look for all the evidence and put it together. If you get to that point, then yeah, it is logical and necessary that you would call for the expulsion of that member, and that you would hope, as difficult as it is, that you could get a critical mass of Republicans to accept that idea.
And, you know, you've hit on the fact that Donald Trump, even though he hasn't announced, you know, the writing's on the wall pretty much about his decision for 2024. I mean, we learned this week that you already have the Secret Service down there in Palm Beach requesting meetings with city officials and police officers to plan out security, possible road closures. I mean, behind the scenes, those wheels are definitely in motion. And it would be incredibly dangerous because, again, as you said, he's already not accepted the results of 2020. He will definitely not accept the results of 2024. And another concern I have is, since we know he has no respect for the rule of law, no respect for elections, no respect for precedent, suppose he wins in 2024, does he walk away peacefully after that, after serving a second term? Or do we end up with a horrifying scenario where he attempts to retain power, you know, possibly a Putin here, because he said he admires that, you know, the president for life type thing, you know? And so that's another concern I have. I don't think there's a good way to slice it. Every possible scenario moving forward with Trump is absolutely terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that we are looking at realities that are impossible to deny. And yet, much of our media, much of our political class tends to deny them. And that is simply absurd. It's a huge, huge problem. And if we do not get real about this, if we don't focus on the genuine threat, then I think you see a degeneration of our politics there. And it's not necessarily just about Trump. It is about the realities that extend from this moment, where the results of elections are somehow seen as fluid, that you can get the result you want if you fight hard enough, upset things hard enough, disrupt things enough. And if that's the case, if that's what we're looking at, then American democracy is an incredibly dangerous place. It's vulnerable at a level that we haven't seen, I would argue, since the Civil War era. And I don't think we have to go there. I don't think we have to accept that. But to avoid that reality, we've got to crack down on the people that were involved in January 6th. And in doing so, we send a message not just to those individuals, but to other individuals, right up to and including Donald Trump.
You know, you mentioned accepting election results, and I think that's a good place to pivot here for a moment, because we had some election results this week. State of Virginia obviously did not go the way that Democrats had wanted. And so in the, you know, time since that election, we have seen a lot of analysis, you know, oh, it's the progressives' fault. Oh, it's the centrists' fault. It's the moderates. It's Biden. It's the Republicans with the CRT, you know, brainwashing people into thinking this is a thing they have to fight against. And look, there's probably a lot of truth to a lot of these points here. But I know you've already done a ton about what happened on Tuesday. So I'm hoping you could talk with us for just a moment here about this. So give me your thoughts specifically about Virginia. You know, what do you think played big roles in Terry McAuliffe's
sure.
loss?
Well, I think that there's multiple levels. First and foremost, whether you like it or not, Glenn Youngkin proved to be a pretty effective candidate. He was a capable candidate, and he presented himself as a mild, relatively reassuring Republican to the broader audience, while at the same time kind of winking and nodding to the Trump base. And that was very effective. That's sort of a classic Republican model, which he reinvigorated. And I think we have to take that seriously, that what he did there, you know, worked on a variety of levels. Second, Terry McAuliffe was a bumbling candidate. He was a former governor trying to come back at a time when I think people were looking for fresh faces. He made a lot of mistakes in his campaign, and they came back to haunt him. The next thing that I think is relevant is that there is simply no question that Youngkin weaponized the debate about critical race theory for political purposes and ran a very very ugly campaign, in which, you know, which really reminded you in many ways of the campaigns in the 1970s, where politicians complained about so-called forced busing for integration. I mean, it was very racially charged. It was very, kind of dog whistling, and to some extent, he got away with it, or at least it looks to have had some success. But when we take those three realities, Youngkin, pretty capable candidate, McAuliffe, mistakes, the weaponization of the CRT, which, by the way, is an incredibly dishonest thing to do in the way that they did, and put them all together, they stand in one place. The overarching reality, and the thing that we have to be conscious of, is that this is an election that was in many ways nationalized, as was the election in New Jersey and some other elections around the country. People were looking at what's going on in Washington, and you have Democrats in charge. They control the White House and both houses of Congress, and they're looking relatively dysfunctional. They're not governing. They are negotiating with themselves. They're fighting with themselves. The whole thing is falling apart because two corporate-aligned centrists refuse to go along with 96% of Democrats in Congress. And we can make all the excuses we want for it, and certainly we can criticize Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but we do have to recognize that the picture that comes out of Washington is one of Democrats just struggling to govern. And that's problematic when it comes back into an off-year or midterm election, because people look at that and they say, well, maybe we should give the other guys a chance. And it also, that for the small group of swing voters, for the in the much broader sense, I think it causes, or it can cause, a lot of voters who are likely to be Democrats, who would never vote for a Republican, to just, you know, become disenchanted, to stay home, to give up. And that was bad. It's a bad situation on Tuesday night, but it's a disastrous situation for Democrats if that's how it plays out in 2022.
Well, you know, you and I, and I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast, everybody watching this video, we're news consumers. You know, we report on this. We talk about it. We dive into it every single day. And what gets lost, I think, sometimes with not necessarily speaking about us here, but some of the other folks, is we tend to forget that most people in this country are not the same kind of news consumers that we are. You know, and of course, we know what's happening with these negotiations. We know what's in the bill. We know what's out of the bill. We know who's being funded by which, you know, corporations, that's making them block this thing and that thing. The average person out there doesn't dig that deep. And that's not their fault. You know, they're doing their lives. Washington, D.C. is this far off place that, you know, doesn't appear to be working right now. And when you only have that cursory glance, that's what you get from that. You see that, okay, well, the Democrats are in charge. They're not getting along. Nothing's done. I'm going to go to the other side. And I know people get annoyed when voters do that. But again, they're not consuming everything like we are. So we kind of do have to take a step back sometimes and realize just the optics of this, you know, what it looks like at a cursory glance. And that's plays a huge role in these elections, like what happened in Virginia.
Absolutely. That's, you just summed it up perfectly. And I think that's a really vital thing to understand. If you're coming to somebody who is maybe super smart, super engaged on a lot of levels, but really busy, they've got demanding lives and there's a lot going on. They can't, you know, do what a pundit or a radio host or somebody does all the time and go through every poll and every bit of nuance and that. And so they're getting baseline signal. And the baseline signal that they get is, okay, we elected a president. We elected Democrats to the House and Senate. They promised a lot of stuff. Where are the receipts? Where's the reality? Where's the delivery of what you promised? And then you say, well, darn that filibuster, or, darn that Joe Manchin. Well, for a lot of folks, it's sort of like, no, we didn't really elect you to make excuses. We elected you to govern. And if you got a problem governing, figure out how to do it. And so I've said this for quite a while. I think that the Democrats at the highest level, the president and leaders in Congress, made a huge mistake when they didn't figure out who was on board and who wasn't before they put the package together, right? I mean, that's just bad planning. But then if they had some trouble or some shaky people that weren't quite on board, but they thought they could get them on board, second huge mistake was not to, upon launching the program, go out and make the biggest noise ever about what's in it. Go talk about paid family and medical leave. Go talk about expanding Medicare to include vision, hearing, and dental. Go talk about expanding Medicaid to involve caregiving. Go talk about, making community college free. Go talk about ending poverty with a child, or not ending, but addressing poverty with a child tax credit. And go talk about addressing the challenges facing the planet with a real response to energy issues. I mean, these are all popular. They're very popular. Go build a movement of people that are super enthusiastic about it. Make a lot of noise about it. Make it the central issue. Get your wavering folks, a Joe Manchin or a Kyrsten Sinema, on board because it's so popular they can't afford to not be there, and then pass it quickly. I mean, that's just the bottom line. I mean, that's how it's supposed to work. And I know it sounds easy when I talk about it, and I recognize it can be harder. But at the end of the day, people aren't going to give you that much slack if you don't deliver. They might say, well, just politics doesn't work for me. And losing people from the process, having people just get disenchanted and turn off, that is, especially in midterms, an incredibly destructive circumstance.
Right. And we see it all the time. And that, I feel like that historically plays a role in why usually the party that wins the White House will lose, the following midterms, which is historically what usually happens. Not always, but usually. But it is because, this party's in charge now. My life is no different. I'm looking at my bills. My bills are the same. I'm looking at my pay. My pay is the same. So I guess let's switch back over to this side and see if that makes anything better for me. Because that, at the end of the day, I know a lot of people, yes, obviously hugely partisan, but a lot of people in this country just look at it like, listen, who's going to make my life better? I'll try this party. If you don't do it, I'll go back to this one. And if they don't do it, I'm coming back to you. And you end up with this yo-yo because people are always just looking for something that's going to make their lives better. And, when they see they don't get it, they may not be paying attention to the fact that maybe it's coming, maybe it's not. It's not there right now. And so the party in power pays the price for that.
Yeah, I think that's a reality. Again, I think a lot of people just, they don't shift. They literally just shut off. They say, okay, I'm done with this. I'm not going to bother to go vote because I just don't see something. I don't see anything coming from it. And that's probably the most dangerous reality. But I will, put a exclamation mark on the point you just made, because there are indeed some swing voters. And there's evidence out of Virginia that a surprisingly substantial number of voters in the particularly the northern suburbs of Virginia voted for Joe Biden in 2020 and then voted for Glenn Youngkin in 2021. Because the exit polls suggest that about 17% of folks who said they can't stand Donald Trump voted for Glenn Youngkin. So that's, 1 in 5 of the people who can't stand Trump or don't like Trump voted for Biden. That's a lot of people.
It really is. And look,
or voted for Youngkin, I mean.
Yeah, they Democrats have a year. They got 1 year to get this figured out. So let's hope they can. I'd love to have optimism. I don't know that I do at the moment, though. But listen, John Nichols, a national affairs correspondent with The Nation. Find him on Twitter at Nichols Uprising. Thank you so much for talking with me again today. It's always great to have you on. It's been many years since you and I have spoken, and it's great to just pick up like we never had a pause.
I really appreciate that. And it's been a great conversation. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, John.
Thanks, man.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire. But don't forget, starting next week, we will have the members-only portions of the show. Again, my apologies for not being able to get that out this week. But you can go to rofpodcast.com to sign up, become a member. And you can find this podcast on Facebook, Facebook Podcasts. You can also, if you choose to go a different route, you can become a member on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Go to the community tab at the top of the page. See all the perks of signing up there, because in addition to getting the podcast, depending on which tier, you also get exclusive content 5 days a week. Same thing over on our Patreon page at patreon.com/TheRingOfFire. Same benefits, same costs as the YouTube community page. So if you want to go either of those routes, there is no difference in the tiers. They're all the same. But again, thank you all so much for listening. I hope that I can live up to expectations here at Ring of Fire. I have, again, I've been with Ring of Fire for over 17 years. I've poured my heart and soul into every project we have ever had here. And I promise you that is not going to change with this podcast. So thank you all for listening. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/FarronBalanced. You can also get me on Facebook at facebook.com/FarronBalanced. And of course, follow Ring of Fire itself on Twitter at Ring of Fire Media. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening.